Anybody like a little more time? Okay. Well, we'll see how far. I'd like to make some good strides today. In Romans 11, this has been, it's been good. It's been 2 weeks, and now we have to kind of shake our brains, say, what was Romans all about? God's great salvation to us, and the peak of it comes in Romans chapter 8, the great promises. It goes from no condemnation to no separation from God. All those wonderful questions at the end, what can separate us from the love of God? And everything that's built into that, this is great assurance for us as believers. Really kind of enjoyed that, but we've looked at how the topic in 9 through 11 is the salvation of Israel. And is Israel, are they a contradiction to the promises that have been given to us? And because they were foreknown and they were chosen, and these words that are applied to us were applied to them. And his response to this is no. They have not obtained salvation because of their unbelief. But he's asking now in chapter 11 two main questions. The first one was found in verse 1. Hath God cast away his people forever? Let's see here. The question here for us is, do those who are in covenant theology, do they believe that God has cast away his people? I'm going to say this in the wrong, it's a trick question. So I've already let you know that the answer is not what you think it's going to be. They would say, no, God hasn't cast away his people. So that's something they kind of put in your mind. They believe that they're not cast away. They can still be saved and added to the church. But as a national entity in God's plan for them, that is, they would say, yes, on that scale. So I guess it's how you define it. They would say they have been cast away. So that's where we're going to, that's not going to be the focus, but if I make an argument and I try to tell you, hey, wait a second, this, as we go through this, this cannot be referring to the remnant, because that's what they believe. The nation is still being, is still a remnant of them is being saved. God hasn't cast them off, but is that remnant something greater to come? That's going to be the focus of our discussion here today. So the question here that comes down is that, yes, rejection is only partial because a remnant is being saved. That's the Apostle Paul's talking about a remnant according to the election of grace. But then he also says that the rest of them, the remainder of them, were blinded. So that's where we ended last time, very sobering passage. And now we come to our second question. And I say, have they stumbled that they should fall? You say, where did this question come from? I think you can trace the word, have they stumbled, back to verse 9. He says, let their table be a snare and a trap and a stumbling block. So they stumbled over Jesus. He was their table. He was their provision. And we connected this back to Jesus because this is a quotation from the Old Testament, one verse removed from a direct quotation about the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, a prophecy. So that's part of what we're, that's why when I think of their table, the provision of God, I'm thinking Jesus Christ. And because they would not believe on him, they stumbled at him, their eyes were darkened, that they could not see. And so they have stumbled. This means that the nation as a whole, they have stumbled. They did not believe. A remnant has believed. Apostles and prophets, they were all, the church at the beginning was all Jewish. A remnant has believed. But the nation as a whole, they have stumbled. And he asks that they should fall. Have they stumbled? Have this misstep, this unbelief, is it to a place where they've fallen? And the idea here is irrevocably. So the whole context of this is not talking about a remnant misstepping. It's talking about a nation in contrast with the remnant. Because the remnant have not stumbled, they have believed. But the nation has not. They've stumbled. Is it that they should fall, the entire nation? And I think when you understand that aspect, it becomes very clear when he says, God forbid. And so this is the question, I think, that's even more... galvanizes my mind as a dispensationalist, that God has a plan for the nation of Israel. And he says, but rather through their fall, salvation is come unto the Gentiles for to provoke them to jealousy. I'm reading in the book of Acts right now. And you can say that the book of Acts is a commentary on that verse. Over and over again, the opposition to the gospel and the Apostle Paul's ministry came from the Jews. Now, he would come into a city and he would preach the gospel to the Jews, and that was where he was, his starting place. But they would, in city after city, they would reject him. He would go, and the Gentiles would receive him. And so the book of Acts ends with a quotation from Isaiah 6. And he says, well said Isaiah, the Holy Ghost in Isaiah, about you. Apostle Paul saying this. And he quotes from Isaiah 6:9-10, the very words that we're talking about, that they have eyes that they could not see, and they were blinded. And he says, henceforth we will go to the Gentiles. So that becomes a major focus of the book of Acts towards the latter half of that book. And God has a purpose for the conversion of the Gentiles. It's not just to save us, but our salvation is meant to provoke them to jealousy. We're supposed to know God so well and have a relationship with Him and have a joy in our hearts and have a peace and have a life that's being lived that says, that person knows God, that a Jewish person says, I wish I had that. That's part of God's plan, is to provoke this nation to jealousy. Remember how we read in Deuteronomy, how he says, you're provoking me to jealousy with your idols. I wish you were mine, but you're running off to other things. I'm going to bring and I'm going to save somebody else, and they're going to provoke you to jealousy. So there's a real interesting aspect of the justice of God in which he is pulling them to himself through this. And so then he goes on to reason. He says, now you can kind of see, let's offer the basis of this salvation. If the fall of them be the riches of the world, the stumbling where they have disbelieved the gospel, if it be the riches of the world, the gospel has gone to the Gentiles, and the diminishing of them, the riches of the Gentiles, how much more than their fullness? So here's his reasoning, based on what we just looked at. The gospel went out to the whole world, partly because of their rejection. God wanted the gospel to go to the world to bring his own people back to himself. And he says, there is going to be something really wonderful when they return. Maybe an illustration of this might be someone who's driving, you know, we don't have many of these cars, but are there old cars to this day that don't have power steering? So you get out there and think of someone, if there's an aspect that says, hey, if you can drive a car without power steering, how much easier is it going to be with power steering? You're going to be like, ooh, wow, this is pretty nice. I hardly have to do any work about this thing. You know, I feel like I'm actually turning the tires themselves with the wheel. This is the idea. God says there's going to be a super blessing to the world when they are brought back to him. This idea of diminishing is like a suffering, a defeat. Their fall, their defeat is their current condition right now in unbelief. So the nation, we can look at Israel right now, they are currently in unbelief. But is their unbelief much different than their unbelief with Moses? And their unbelief under Jeroboam? And their unbelief at the Babylonian captivity? And their unbelief that led them to AD 70, the rejection of Jesus? Because he says they have been blinded, the Apostle Paul's writing, unto this very day. And he's quoting from Deuteronomy. Now let's ask the question. Back at Exodus when they had unbelief, were they his chosen people? And were they his chosen people when Jesus came? Are they his chosen people today, even in unbelief? They've always had the spirit of unbelief. That's what we've been arguing. So there's an aspect, sometimes we get this mentality because of what God did to them in 70 AD or what happened in the captivity, that something has changed. It hasn't changed. God's plan for them is still the same. And he's going to make a point about that that's very sobering. So there is a significance, the things that have happened to them, we should have certain thoughts about that. But it's very, very important to think through these things. So when he says, okay, well, some of my notes are pulling together verse 15 together too at the same time, so we haven't got to 15, so we'll keep going. For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify my office. So the apostle Paul was commissioned to go to the Gentiles. That's why he says, I'm the apostle to the Gentiles. When he was saved, the book of Acts tells us that he received a vision while he was in the temple, an additional vision, not the one on the road to Damascus, but when he came back to Jerusalem, he received a vision in which God says, you need to leave the city, they're not going to receive you, and I'm going to send you to the Gentiles. And if you read that in the book of Acts, he was actually telling that story while all the Jews, they tried to beat him up, and the Romans came in and rescued him and preserved him. And he told them, he says, God sent me to the Gentiles. And it was at that word that the riot began again. And they began to take off their clothes and throw up dirt. And they're like, we do not like the Gentiles. I mean, it's like, whoa. The animosity that was there that said, this away with this man. This man deserves to die. Because God sent him to the Gentiles. So very clearly, the Apostle Paul had a ministry to the Gentiles. Just like he talks about this in Galatians, Peter was the apostle to the Jews, and he was the apostle to the Gentiles. And he says, I'm magnifying my office. What's he mean by that? He says, when my ministry happens, the greatest blessing that's ever been on the earth is going to happen. Because it's not that God has forsaken the Jewish people, but through the ministry of the Gentiles and the church and what he's doing over here, he is intending to come back to this people. And when I fulfill my ministry over here in the church, this is going to take place over here, and the greatest blessing. And he says, man, what a great ministry I have. I magnify my office. He said, I got an important job to do for the Lord. That's kind of the idea he has behind this. And he says, if by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh and might save some of them. So where is the apostle? He's apostle to the Gentiles. But does that mean that his focus is off of the Jews? Not at all. In fact, he sees the ministry of the church and the Gentiles as a means to reaching the people of his own flesh, his own people, to provoke to emulation, to make them envy, the same idea there, so that some of them might be saved. And he says, if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, casting away, pointing back to the fall. God didn't make them fall, they disbelieved. But God's response to them has been, okay, you're hardened, you're blinded, you're going to stay in your state of unbelief, I am going to go to the Gentiles, they're going to receive it. He says, they're being cast away. Then he says, what shall the reconciling of, be the reconciling of the world? That's us coming to God through the message of salvation. What shall the receiving of them be? All right, so think through that, just so you understand. Maybe I'm being really elementary here and everybody understands it already. But if they have rejected the Lord in unbelief, and that's called the casting away, and over here he says, now, what will the receiving of them be? Over here is unbelief. nationally, what is the receiving going to be? Belief nationally. So when he's using contrast, and when you take the contrast and you apply one side to the other, you begin to understand he is saying this is the plan of God to receive them. And he says, yes. Yes, yeah, you're right, because I've kind of done this with Gentiles and Jews, but at this point we're talking about the contrast in this verse, which is Israel and unbelief being cast away. There's coming a future time, and he's saying, what's going to happen when he receives them? And so he's, okay, maybe if I cast them away, maybe I'll do this. He receives them back. Maybe that puts the picture a little bit better for you visually. But he's going to receive them back, and he says, if they're casting away, what God used through this bad thing was to bring the gospel to you and me, and now we have been reconciled throughout the whole world, this message, what's going to be the result? And he says, life from the dead. Now, there are two different possibilities. One is that there is going to be a literal resurrection of the Gentiles from the graves, because he talks about receiving of the argumentation is, this is what happened when Israel does this, this is what happens to the world. And so when this happens to Israel, this is what's going to happen to the world. So when we talk about life from the dead, he's talking about not just life from the dead for them. He's talking about for the entire world, if that makes sense. The argumentation, he's moving from one to the other. So, and the other possibility is a great spiritual awakening, in a spiritual sense, life from the dead. If we look at the book of Revelation, we see that both of those things are going to take place. It's going to be during that great period of time, there's 144,000 witnesses from the 12 tribes of Israel. That God's going to, he's doing a work in them and through them. And so that from that ministry in Revelation chapter 7, I think it's 7, we find at the end of that, there is a number that cannot be named, that cannot be numbered, of so many people who have been saved during that 7-year period of time. So during the time of great persecution will be a time of great revival. And he's going to use his people to be the catalyst for that. So there's going to be a reception of him in that point, but there's an aspect that I believe at the end of that tribulation period, we know that they are going to see him whom they have pierced, and they are going to mourn. Jesus is going to come back physically, bodily, to rescue them at the Battle of Armageddon, and the entire nation is going to realize their error of rejecting the Lord Jesus Christ. And they are going to mourn like they have never mourned before in repentance. Like the mourning for the loss of their only son, as the Bible says in Zechariah chapter 12. And at that place, when Jesus comes back, there is going to be the resurrection of the righteous. And every Old Testament saint is going to be resurrected at the end of that 7-year period of time, and they are going to all enter into the millennial kingdom of Jesus Christ. And this world is going to be transformed when the nation receives Jesus Christ. And so Isaiah chapter 2, Zechariah chapter 8 talks about this, that's this coming day when people are going to come to the Jews and for the blessing, because they have received the Lord. And it's talking about the millennial kingdom of Christ. So I think those are the implications for that. There may be a sense, you know, some people want to argue, I don't know if this is something further in my notes or not, but some people feel like God's going to go backwards to go to the nation of Israel because he was working with them, and so this is their mindset. Okay, God's working through a family with Abraham, and then a nation, and then the whole world. Why would God go backwards in the plan of God back to the nation of Israel? And so their whole mindset and thinking is, that can't be true. God's plan all along was to get to the nations, and but the reasoning that we find here is, when God goes back to the nation, he's not going backwards. He's going forward. Because when he gets this nation, his chosen people, in line with him and receiving him and obedience to him, that becomes the channel for all the world. It's not something that's going backwards. It's something going incredibly forward for the nations of the world and for the Gentiles. So that type of reasoning and that type of thinking, I think this passage just smashes that. And I think that is a huge holdback for people against dispensationalism. All right, let's see how fast I can get this. I don't think I can do the next. I want to get to several verses here, but we'll see how quickly we can go. Verse 16, two illustrations of what he's talking about. He says, if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy, and if the root be holy, so are the branches. The argument here is the substance bears the same nature as its source. Don't you like it when I say it? You're like, illustration is so much better. When you try to define it, I said that, okay, the substance is the same as its source. I have no idea about this, but I've seen my wife make Amish bread. All right, you take Amish bread and you like use a portion of it, right? And you cook it, but you save some of it. And then you add more stuff to it, and da-da-da, it keeps doing its stuff, and the yeast and all that kind of stuff, and it just keeps multiplying, and it's like rabbits. My wife kind of gave up after a while. I love it. It's very good, but she's like, this is too much to keep track of all this. You gotta give it away, I guess. This is kind of the idea here. What you started off with yeast, and you add something else to it, and you take something else away, he says, okay, what you have here is the second part. What you see from the second part, you have to understand that the first part was that way too, because you were taken out of that. Okay, maybe that illustration is not as helpful. Maybe think of it in this time terms of the root and branches. You've got some branches. Well, the root's the same kind of tree because it's holding up the branches. So now he's going to argue from this. What are the root? The root, I believe, is the patriarchs of the nation Israel, because later he's going to say in verse 28, as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. So God made certain promises to the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they are beloved. God's made a covenant. He continues to love them because of those, the roots, the very beginnings. The natural, let's read verse 17, I'll explain it. If some of the branches be broken off, and thou, being a wild olive tree, wert grafted in among them, and with them partakest of the root and fatness of the olive tree. So we have natural branches. That's not the remnant. That's not the root and the patriarchs and Israel coming up, and then the people who believe in Jesus. Those are the next. Because he says that the natural branches can be broken off. So if you believe that the branches are the remnant of Israel that have believed on Jesus and they can be broken off, that would be teaching what? You can lose your salvation. Okay, so it's not talking about them. It's talking about unbelieving Israel in the generations of Jewish people that have been growing up. Every generation is another branch of the tree, and they are the natural branches that descend from the patriarchs. These are unbelieving Jews. And they, through their fall, their stumble, their disbelief, have been broken off. And he says, you are wild branches. Now, wild branches is talking about, in some sense, we need to think collectively, just like he said, the branches are the Jewish generations of Jewish people, and they continue to disbelieve, and they're broken off. we need to think of this in terms of generations of Gentiles. Because otherwise, if he talks about you being broken off, there's an element there that he's not talking about us individually losing your salvation. He's talking about in terms of groups of people. And the wild branches, they're wild. They're Gentiles. And yet, they're believing in Jesus, and they're being grafted in to this tree. Now, I don't know much about, this type of thing. but supposedly, those who know better this is very, very unusual. You don't graft wild olive trees. And the unbelievers of the Bible would say, see, Paul didn't even understand his illustration. He didn't understand that doesn't even happen. I think, no, that's part of the point. God's doing a miracle here. God's taking out natural branches that don't ever, you never do this in husbandry and with vines and things like that. He says, yet God is doing it for us. So he begins to make application to us in verse 17, I think, is where it begins, because he says, and thou. So he's saying you. So he begins to very clearly start pointing to them specifically. You're a wild olive tree. You're grafted in. He says, I want to make an application. He's going to give four imperatives in this passage. The first one is, boast not against the branches. If thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee. So he's basically saying, stop. He's not saying, don't do this, better not do this. I'm warning you, the way that this imperative is, you're doing it, stop doing it. And he says, stop boasting yourself against the Jews. And he's, it's interesting that the Jews, they have a great feeling of superiority to Gentiles. Is that not true? And he's saying this, what is true for them and the way they felt towards Gentiles can actually be reversed. And the Gentiles of the church can begin to feel superior towards them. He said, you're not superior to them. In fact, it's just the opposite. You are the wild olive trees. They are we are unnatural. We have no right, no nature to be a part of them. We don't belong here. And so he's basically saying, we are dependent upon Israel. Israel is not dependent upon you. The root bears the branches. The branches don't bear the root. He's not just saying here that don't boast because boasting would be a sin. He's saying, no, you don't boast because literally you are inferior to them in the plan of God. But whoa, do not boast yourself against them. And he says, I know what you'll say. You'll say this, thou wilt say then, the branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. And that's true. That was part of God's plan. He was able to use their being broken off so that you could be grafted in. But there's an aspect which, when one is taken out for the sake of another, it always will seem like that God favors the latter more than the former. That's natural thinking. That happens with parents and children. All right, you get to sit in the good seat. I get to sit in the good seat. No, you're not. So sit in the back. Someone else sits in the seat. Oh yeah, I'm now. No, that's. But we have that tendency in our heart to think, oh, I've been preferred. I am of greater importance. And he says, you're going to say that. Yes, you have been grafted in. You, that's true. But don't come to this place where you think of yourself so great. He says, well, because of unbelief, they were broken off. You think about why did you get sent back to the back? They got sent back to the back because of their attitude, okay? Why did they get broken off? Because of their unbelief. He says, thou standest by faith. And is faith meritorious in any way? Do we have some merit before God because we simply believed his word? No. That's faith is, and he says, be not high-minded. Don't, this is more along the lines of what we might have thought he was saying earlier with boast not, but he's basically saying, don't get a lofty perspective of yourself. But he says, you should fear. What? He says, Gentile Christians should fear because of what God did to Israel. You mean Bethel Community Baptist Church should fear because of what God did to Israel? Now he goes on. He says, for if God spared not the natural branches, and he did not, take heed lest he spare thee not thee as well. And these are not, he's not trying to put up just a hypothetical. He's basically saying, God, look what God did to them when they had unbelief. God will do the same thing to you if you turn from faith as well. Now, he's not talking about individuals. I think he's talking about in terms of groups. We'll look at this. And so this verse 22, I didn't have you read far enough. Fourth imperative. Behold, therefore, the goodness and severity of God. On them which fell, severity, but toward thee, goodness. If thou continue in his goodness, otherwise thou also shall be cut off. That's why we should fear. Because if we do not continue in the goodness of God, we will be cut off. So what are the two things you're supposed to stop and look at? The goodness and severity. Severity is applied to who? Unsaved Jewish people. Goodness as applied to us, the Gentiles being brought in. Let's stop and just for a moment and think about what is the severity of God to the unbelieving Jews. It starts with Jesus' prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. The time of that taking place is a time of great horror. The Jewish people in the city of Jerusalem had all gathered in the temple because a false prophet told them, everybody go to the temple, you're going to hear about the blessing, you're going to see the sign of God's deliverance. And around them was the Roman army of Titus. And during that time, the war broke out. There was panic among the people. Fire, I don't have time to even go into the details because we're already late. Whatever. This is part of, I really want to land this point hard, and yet we don't have time to do it. So, I don't know. I just, it's very, I guess I could go over it quickly and return to it, but you just think about what they have suffered. They suffered during that time horrific, unspeakable horrors of massacre. The crusaders who came to liberate them, killing whole families. Parents would kill their own children. Mothers would stuff rocks into their dresses and jump into the lake rather than be caught by the crusaders. In England, they had a home until the 1200s when there was a man who converted to Judaism. He was seen as a corrupting influence, and they started spreading these lies about them that they crucified Christian children and drank their blood and they were using illegal currency, and so he expelled them. And everybody in the city, it was like someone came to you and said, you have to leave your homes, you've got to go. And you've got nowhere to go. In the continent, in France, Louis IX decided that they could, these Jews had money, that they could be extorted and they had to wear badges, yellow badges on their to identify them, just like the Nazis did for them. They were extorted. In Poland, they were the Cossacks, the Corsacks, and the torture and the genocide that took place. Spain was one of the largest. It's like New York City today. Where's the largest population of Jewish people today? In the United States. I think that's still true. It used to be in Spain, and the Inquisition came to them. Over a third of the Jews in Spain were killed. A third went homeless. And we're not talking about what the Jews, they migrated to Russia and the pogroms. And in Ukraine, you read about the history of what happened in Ukraine, one of the most anti-Semitic places that have been, you think about what's taking place in Ukraine, they are reaping some of their judgment of God for what the way they treated the Jewish people. during World War II and before, the Holocaust in Germany, and was not to speak about the terrorist attacks that have been taking place towards them in the nations, and the bombings and the murder and the stuff that's not even reported on a daily basis. Our news media won't touch it. But the killings and the stabbings and things that take place inside their borders. The severity of God against this people. But the question is, what about us as the church? You know what? If we all we have to look back is and see the severity of God, where's the church in Europe today? Where's the church in England today? Where's the church in northern Egypt today? Where's the church in Palestine area today? Because these are places where the gospel was flourishing and preaching of the gospel went forward. And I have a great burden from what we're seeing here. We were going to look back and say, where is the church in America? I believe that the pages are closing on our time in the gospel. And yet we have such an abundance of resources. And we have such a prosperity. We ought to fear. Maybe we'll return to that too again and to flush this out and say, what does this mean? What does it look like? And what ought we to do? Part of it is, I wanted to finish with that because the answer to what ought we to do is going to be answered in some ways in the morning message today. And so it's something that the Lord just feels like He's, in my own heart, He's squeezing me in. He is taking the Word of God and saying, Ben, I'm getting ready to show you what I want you to do. I want that your life must change. Just an interesting feeling, personally, just to unveil that through the revival meetings and through the preparation of these things, saying, I better fear because I'm not okay. There has to be something in my life that demonstrates the faith of what we're talking about. But anyway, I can't get into all of it, so we'll come back to it next week, Lord willing, if the Lord tarries till then. So you're dismissed. Sorry about taking this long.